Welcome to Headlines. This is David Lichtenstein here in the Yeshiva Shalmaila. We're going to continue last week's program about Indian here in Shetlach. And I got a lot of calls, and a number of them felt that I was biased. I didn't put on enough of the anti. So this week we're going to continue. We're going to start off with a recap of last week's, a short recap, maybe 7 or 8 minutes of the main bullet points of the prior last week's. And then we will have a new group of speakers. We will have Rabbi Eli Bone, who's written about it extensively. He's the Mechaber. He's the author of Halacha Brura. We will have an Indian priest on, telling us how he understands hair tonsuring, the shaving of the heads. Then we will have Rabbi Leza Pashkes. He's a Ram in Kleisenberg, who spent a lot of time researching this topic. And then we will have Mrs. Berger, who is the primary researcher for the anti Indian hair components, so it should be an interesting program. Our British number had a number of problems a few weeks ago. Our England, United Kingdom, it is working. It is 330-117-0250. That's 330-117-0250. And our Israeli number, which had a little bit of a hiccup, is also working fine. It's 02, that's Yerushalayim, 372-0304. Before we go back to the question of the Indian Shetlach, I would like to, just after working on this topic for a few weeks, some interesting thoughts. One is that we don't know. We've had a number of experts, and we'll hear some people who claim to be experts, I mean, who are, some people are poskening from the internet and from internet comic books, etc., as to what the intent of the Galachim are. Many experts say clearly it was established emetarlo, and you'll hear our priests, etc., that say clearly it is not takrevis avodah zarah. Let's assume for a moment it's not clear. I concede we have disagreements. We have Rabbi Donner, we have a number of other rabbanim who say that no, that's not the intent of the thing. So the question is, we don't know what the intent is. So it's a suffix. Another suffix is, we certainly don't know the intent of the Avdei Avodah Zarah. Like the people who go then shave their heads, well, some people think like this, some people think like that. It's another suffix. A third suffix is, and here's a suffix that we will speak about Rabbi Bone briefly, is if somebody were to go into a church and shave their head in front of Isaiah Ish and say he's doing it as a gift, the priest would chase him out with a broom and say, why are you making our church dirty? In other words, the idea being is, whose job is it to be koveya, what is an avoda? Is it the church at its kaimrim, its galachim, its, you know, the establishment, the institution? Or could any group of random avdim say, no, we're doing something different? Now, we believe, we have a few rayas, it's not clear, but it's certainly, it's sad to say that if you go to a church and you start cutting your hair or dancing the kazatska, the hora, that it's nothing, you're just a meshugana, right? Even if a million people do it, but it's the institution of the church that establishes avodah zarah. So even if the people did have this kavana to do it as a takrivis, it would still be nothing because it's shalai kederach avodasa. It's not an avodah. It's not up to them to be kaveya. So we have two sfeikas, at least a sfeika. What is the intent? What is the meaning of the galachim? And does it even matter what these people are thinking if the galachim or kaveya under? Now, why is this the geya? Because the Shulchan Aruch in Simin Kufyud says that if something is a suffix, whether it's avodah zarah, and here we have two sfeikas or three sfeikas, right? Then it's batal in the second eruv, when it gets put into its second grouping, right? Even though it's echad be'elef le'batal, and its second eruv is. So this would have a real implication, and this, to me, is not even a suffix anymore. It's a sfeika. At the very least, I think Rabbi Dana would have to concede that many, we're not sure who is the kaveh here. Now, additionally, in Rabbi Yashiv's letter to Rabbi Belsky, he writes 75% of the hair comes from the temples. And we've had the number one expert in the world, who's Emma Tarla, who spent 30 years, she didn't do it off the internet, she spent a dozen years in India, and she says, no, it's a real minority, right? So I just think that a lot of the information here that the Rabbanim have seems to be questionable, and that is something that we are struggling with. So this is my Ara, and I want to again say, please do not paskin from this show. This is just to be Ma'ira, just to make you better informed, to allow you to ask better shilas. I plead with you not to listen, take anything like this halacha lamaisa. Ask your local Talmud Chacham, Paisik, who knows his way around Hilchos Avodah Zarah. And that's it, and now let's go to the program. This is a brief synopsis of last week's interviews. Here from California, we have a Baal Tshuva who actually lived in India and almost, I would say, studied, practiced the Hindu faith for a while. I'm not sure how to exactly, but he lived there. He wasn't religious. He was part of it. And here's what he says about what they believe in and how the Rabbanim who went to India for a few days to check out the faith and speak from a translator to a translator as to what's going on. Here's his thoughts about it.
Part of the vow is that you're going to go to Tirupati and you're going to bring some gifts to the temple. And as part of the preparation for this, you give you offer your hair. Now I use that word offer, not in a technical sense, right? Not in the sense of making an offering, but that you donate your hair. Okay, you donate your hair, knowing that the hair is going to be removed from your head, and it's going to be packaged up, and it's going to be sold. Okay,
who are you offering it to?
This is where the language becomes kind of a problem. So the word in Tamil for that kind of offering, kanika, it really means a donation, right? Not an offering as in a sacrifice. So this becomes a donation to the temple, and it's a preparation, right? It's included along with bathing and various other things that you do in preparation for going to the temple in fulfillment of your vow. But you're not actually offering the hair to the god. That would not be an acceptable offering.
Why wouldn't you offer your hair?
Because the hair is a shuddha, it's tame, right? It's an impure hair. Barbers, anything in relation to that is completely impure. They have concepts of purity and impurity, and you would never offer something like
this. Is this Hindi? Like, what religion is this?
Okay, this is Hinduism. This is Hinduism.
And I would say, would you say it's like going to the mikveh, sort of? Like, try to give us some type of a reference.
Right, so, exactly. It's a kind of hachana, right? And it's like going to the mikveh, and in fact, they actually do bathe. After you get your hair cut, you would actually bathe.
So would it be sort of like a taglachas of a mitzvah, like just like a mitzvah, you know, before they're tired, they go to the mikveh, they would shave their heads. Would it be similar?
Right, okay. Very similar to that. Now there is another the other dimension to it is you have to remember that both Indian women and Indian men put a lot of energy into their hair. I mean, say, you know, they often have very long, lustrous, beautiful hair, and it's also a sacrifice of beauty. You know, it is kind of part of it is saying, you know, look, I grew my hair and it was so beautiful. I'm giving that up for you. You know, I'm giving up all of that beauty and coming to you as a simple person. I look like everybody else. And if you've ever seen what bald people look like, you know, everybody kind of looks alike.
Here are some more thoughts.
I did speak to this. I don't think he was so pleased with my speaking about it, but I think part of it is you kind of imagine if a group of Tibetan monks arriving, arriving Motzei Shabbos and seeing Kiddush Levana, right? What would they think was going on there, right? They would look and they'd say, oh, these people are, you know, dancing to the moon, they're praying to the moon. What would they think? Because they don't have access to the text, right? So they don't know what you're reading. They have no idea what it is that you're reciting.
Now, here from Harnof is a Rav who wrote an entire sefer about it, what he's writing about, the percentage of Indian hair that comes from the temple.
I think the first step is to research it on the internet. If you make a Google search, anyone could do this. You can make a Google search, the Tirumala Temple Tansor. Tansor means what they call cutting off their hair. I'm telling you that the first 40, 50 Google results all go ahead and, you know, they're very, very well detailed. They have an entire story, how once upon a time the Sabbai de Zara was going somewhere and it got hit by a shepherd and he became bald in a certain spot. And another Avodah Zarah came and shaved off his head and gave it to that Avodah Zarah. And basically the Avodah Zarah said that anyone who comes to his location and gives here, he will accept the here. This is on Wikipedia for the page, on a Wikipedia page about the temple. This is the detail. The temple actually has a website that gives information of the times of when the halls are open to get your hair cut, and it has this story on that page over there. It's on, I'm saying, if you, it's all over the internet. Not one place, not two places, in tons and tons of places. The nusach on the temple's website basically it says this whole entire story, and it continues on that it's also symbolic because by shaving one's hair, one is removing oneself from his ego.
Right. That everybody agrees on. Whereas it's leaving your ego so that you can meet the Avodah Zarah without your ego. Is that how you would understand it?
Well, I'm just saying that they go ahead, they give an entire story about giving the hair because the Lord one time lost its hair, and now he needs it basically, and because of that, they come and they give its hair. So this is all over the internet.
But let's go back to what you just said. It's about leaving your ego, right?
Yeah. That's
what does that mean?
So let me finish. Basically, I will give a mashal, yeah? Why do we do a Karban Pesach? We go around and ask 100 Yidden, why do we do Karban Pesach? You know what they'll answer? The Pasuk says, Asher Pasach, right? Apate b'nei Yisrael. The reason why we do a Karban Pesach is there's all sorts of reasons, right? The Pasuk says, Beferish, that we go and do a Karban Pesach because HaKadosh Baruch Hu was Pesach on the houses of Klai Yisrael, right?
Right.
Does that mean it's not a Karban? I'm saying that there's tamim of a mitzvah, and then there's the reason why we do a mitzvah. That's by Yiddishkeit. So have the Aleph Aleph Havdalis, right? So by them also, they have this whole entire story, and they go ahead and they continue on the story. I'll read the Lashon on the website. As here, basically, it has the whole story, and it continues on that the Lord saw the sacrifice of the other Lord. He says, all here given to him by devotees in Tirumalah belongs to the Sabbai de Zarah. And then it continues in the next sentence, giving our hair to God is a symbol of leaving our ego.
Right.
So
my question is, what does that mean to you?
So that's what I want to say. Basically, you can't disregard the first half. The first half is saying that the Avodah Zarah has a reason why he wants the hair. It's not saying that removing the hair because the hair is tummy. It's saying, no, the Avodah Zarah wants the hair. That's clear. Now, you want to know why.
Wait. So Rabbi Friedman, what did they take the hair and they used to throw it in the garbage until recently, right?
Oh, one second. Slow down. That's not. We'll get to that in a second. The point that they're giving the here is because this is the reason why they have such a mitzvah.
Because they want it. What was the word with the ego? What was the exact language?
The ego is not before we get to the ego. I want to. The first has an entire story how that way. There's our lost here, so
right.
Before they all come and give their here. Meaning that right, there is some to go ahead and say that there's no shaykhus between to say that it's like, you know, just removing ego. That's not just that. They say that. They say this whole story why the way there's our needs here, and then they have this whole symbolic reason. Why it's like leaving the ego. So it has both halakim. It does say the ego thing, but it says it makes a much bigger emphasis how the Avodah Zarah once lost here and you're giving it here.
Here's Professor Dr. Emmett Harlow from London University who spent 30 years studying here, tantruming. So this is somebody who is a bigger expert on it probably than anybody in the world. She was she gave us a few minutes of her time to do the interview. And she speaks about both what the intent is of the priests who establish the religion, as well as she's going to tell us about the percentage of hair that comes from the temple, an Indian hair. So, Professor Tarlo, I'm an Orthodox Jew.
Yes.
And you know that one of the big brouhahas in our world is, you know, is the hair that comes, that's bought in China, basically shipped from a lot of Hindu temples, is the purpose of the hair when they go to the temple to get their hair shaved, is it as a sacrifice to the deity, similar to like you would give, one of their customs is to give candy to the deity, they give all kinds of, you know, monetary gifts, etc., or is it about cleansing, i.e. it's a prerequisite. Before you come to the deity,
yes.
Shave off ego, shave off pride, remove dirt, they get washed, etc.,
we're trying to find out, according to Hindi theology, in particular Tirumala theology, which is it, A or B? So that's a very, I'm cutting straight to the point here, but I'm wondering if you could share with us some of your extensive knowledge as far as interviewing, et cetera.
Yes, thank you. Well, I've visited several Hindu temples where people undergo the ritual of tonsure. And what's important to understand is that you do not have this tonsure performed inside the temple itself. You go to a special barber hall, it's called a tonsuring hall, and you have your head shaved prior to going into the temple. And when you go into the temple to worship, you don't take with you the hair that's been removed, because your hair is considered a sort of polluting substance. It's a body substance that's been removed from your head. And part of that removal is the idea of cleansing, but it's also the idea of renouncing worldly things, your attachment to the world. So that hair falls to the ground and is taken off for sorting and processing, and it's sold into the wig industry. Whereas the person who's going to worship the god would first take a ritual bath after being shaved and then go into the temple. And what they would offer in the temple is things like flowers and fruits. They would not offer human hair. That would be considered very inappropriate.
Well, so, Professor, is this widely accepted among the theologians, is there a disagreement about it? Like,
for Hindu theologians, that would be clear, you know. And when people go to worship in temples, people, you know, as I say, they offer flowers and fruits, things that are pleasing and pure, and they would certainly not offer human hair. So the human hair is kept separate, and it's removed outside the actual building of the temple. So any expert in Hinduism and theologian within the Hindu tradition would tell you that. And in fact, in relation to the controversy that there was about hair from Indian temples, that was quite a big controversy in 2004, prior to that, back in the 1980s, people from the Orthodox Jewish community had consulted experts of Hinduism, including practicing Hindu priests, who had all told them that, in fact, which is why they had initially made the decision not to ban the hair. But people who go to have their head shaved have different motivations. So one motivation is a lot of people bring very small children, and it's their first shaving of the head. And the first shaving of the head is like, it's considered like a transition into, you know, the next stage of life. So it's an important ritual passage, if you like.
Okay, here is a Rav of the OU, Rabbi Kuber, from also one of the writers of the Art Scroll Shas, who tells us what his investigation has the percentage of hair that comes from India. And vis-a-vis, let's say, Rabbi Yashiv was told that it's 75% of hair comes from the Indian temple. Listen to what Rabbi Kuber says.
But in the end of the day, if they were to import only shade-length hair, it would come out that they would need to cover that dollar figure, they need to import 736 metric tons a year of hair from India. The more lower grade hair they have, that means the more shetal length hair they have to import to cover that. So I would, taking these figures, I would guess that they probably import around 900 metric tons of shetal length hair a year from India. Which means that 85 metric tons doesn't come close to being the figure that being the figure that's not even Rove.
I want to emphasize something that my Yadid, Gaon Rav Aryeh Leibowitz, said. Please do not paskin from this radio program. Ask your local, qualified Rav or Talmud Chacham or Dayan who understands this. And I would also like to say that we did ask Rabbi Sharf of Kedasya, who is, you know, one of the fierce opponents of India, and here he actually accompanied Rabbi Dunner to India, if he would come on and talk about his experience, and he declined. Rabbi Dunner, we reached out to Rabbi Dunner. He said he would do a face-to-face interview at a later date when he's in America. So it could be that Oid Chazayin Lamaid, we will actually interview Rabbi Dunner about this as well. So this should be a very interesting program. Before we begin, let's do our weekly halacha shayla. I'll give you two this week. By the way, last week we had fabulous. We asked the question about Afi Kaiman. We got maybe 50 or 60 people who responded. We will play at the end on a sample of that, and we will be needed to do a raffle every week. We will choose between all the winning answers, and we will send them the two, this is a little bit prejudiced here, a free copy of the last two volumes of Headlines, to which I'm sure if you're a listener, you'll enjoy. So here are two questions for this week. The Chidah writes in Avodas HaKodesh, it's Siman Zayin, Yisrei Shud Zayin, that if you forget one night of Sfiras Omer, he said his exact lashon is lamafreya hayukol habrachos milayla she'avru lavatala. He obviously learns that it's one long series of mitzvahs, and if you forget one, you broke the chain, and it's a bracha lamafreya, and bittel mitzvahs asay, and you mavatal mitzvah sfiras omer. So here's my easier shayla of the night, my easier riddle. Taisus in Ksubis on Ayin Beis Amud Aleph, it's the Ramaskal of a Safrala, says that by a Zava, you don't make a bracha. Why? Because you're afraid the person will forget. I'm sorry, I apologize. He says by a Zava, you don't make a bracha, that you're afraid that after she has days of that Anakiyim, that she's not poilet, that she doesn't see Dam, that she will then be a Raya, and therefore will be oikir the Yemei Tahara, and all the brachas will be lamafreya bracha levatala. And he says, we can't have where something occurs later that causes it to be a bracha levatala retroactively. So what's the difference by a zava you don't count, and by sfiras omer we do count, even though if you forget one night, or one night you're an oinus, lamafreya it comes out that the entire thing was a bracha levatala. This is our easier shayla. And for those of you who want something a little more difficult, here's an interesting question. Taisus and Psachim, that Tzadik Tes says, and it's brought by many of the Paiskim, that he says, by Pesach you should not eat the matzah until it's night, even though there's a din of Taisus Yamtif, but even so you don't eat till the night, because it says, Balayla Teichlu Matzis, and there's a hekish of matzah and myrrh la Pesach. So with this hekish, because of the hekish of Balayla, we say you have to eat the matzu mer, dafka Balayla. This is widely quoted in Sukkah, etc., in many places. That says no taisus yamt. It's the same thing by achila b'sukkah the first night. Okay, now for the harder riddle. Taisim sachim tzadik tes says that you have to eat the matzah dafka Balayla, and you don't say taisus yamt, because there's a hekish of be'erev teichlu matzis, right? And since there's a din of Laila, so it has to be no Tzayis Yomtiv, and it has to be Dafka by night, and I believe the Taz, etc., by Sukkah say the same thing. You make a Hekish, Tesvav, Tesvav, Dafka Balayla. But the Taz says, in Tafresh Samaches, I'm ad-libbing a little bit, that's only by Matzah and by the first days of Sukkot, because you have a Hekish. But the second day, by Shmini Atzeres, if you makabel Shmini Atzeres early, you could eat outside the sukkah, because it's not sukkahs anymore. Taisvis yamtiv is as if it's yamtiv, period. So it's in the afternoon, the sun is shining, you're eating Shmini Atzeres in the house because of Taisvis yamtiv. So the question is that the Mishneh Berurah, you see in Taf Pei Tes, Sif Gimel, here in Sfiras Omer, that's why this is relevant, he brings many achrayinim, a whole pekel of the achrayinim, that if you makabel Shabbos and you mispal Meirav early, so you would say, okay, it's not Friday anymore, it's Shabbos. I have Taisus Shabbos. Well, why can't you count Sfiras Omer? Taisus Shabbos should say. You don't have a hekish here anymore. So just like Taisus Shabbos, Taisus Yomtif says you could eat outside the sukkah if you makabel Shmini Atzeres early, so the sun is shining on Hashanah Rabbah, the sun is shining into your becha, and you're eating in the house, why don't you say the same thing? You makabel Shabbos early, you say Taisus Shabbos has a din of Kedusha Shabbos, and therefore count Sfiras Omer Friday afternoon. That is the second, I think, a little more difficult riddle. We will play an answer next week at the end of the program, and we will be neder for the winning answer. We'll choose one of them. We'll send them a gift. Before we begin this week's program, I'd like to say a little thought. You know, this week is going to be Lag BaOmer. And there's a lot of pshat there, but let me share something that I think is, this is headlines. We like to do something that's current and little halacha and current halacha and political, little political. Let me share with you a thought. What is so special about Lag BaOmer? And there's different thoughts. I'm not so satisfied. What is it, Lag BaOmer, that day? It's, you know, we take one day in the thing. Why was that? So you say that's the day that they stopped dying. Well, why that day? Why didn't they stop dying a day earlier? It's not a coincidence that on the Yom Lamed Gimel BaOmer all this occurred. Like somebody said, isn't it an amazing coincidence that Abraham Lincoln is buried, or I'm sorry, that Ulysses Grant is buried in the Grant tomb? No, it's not a coincidence. So why does all this happen on Lag BaOmer? So let me share with you a machshava. There's 49 days to the Omer, right? If you divide it into thirds, 16, 32, 48. So Lag BaOmer is the inflection point of the last third. It's the first day of the last third. It's really 16.6666, 16.66. So Lag BaOmer is the day mathematically is the beginning of the last third. Now we know in Yiddishkeit, thirds are very important. What do we see? We have Chut HaMishulish, Loi Bimheri Yinatek. We have Avram, we have Yitzhak and Yaakov. What was Avram? Avram did not have the Shvatim. He did not be Mayim in 12 Shvatim. And the great Achrayim say, the Baalei Machshava say, Avram was the kindest man who ever lived. When you think of Avram, you think of any type of social programs, soup kitchens, you think of free gifting, totally turning your eye away to almost any evil that somebody does. Avram only sees good. Totally good, 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 good. Kili Yalem Chazda is Avram. His son Yitzhak is diametrically opposed. Yitzhak is din. What does din mean? You get exactly what you deserve. The halacha says, Ein rachamim bedin. And when you go to court, you could say, look, you know, I stole, but my father was nasty to me. My mother left me. I was molested. Ein rachamim bedin. You owe the money. I'm sorry. So din is exactly measured, right? Diametrically opposed to his father. Yaakov is nonlinear. Rachmim is when you combine, you fuse chesed and din. Rachmim means where it's appropriate, right? And where it's not appropriate, you don't have rachmim. We said, kol ha-merachim al ha-achzarim, soifei la-achzer al ha-rachmanim. Rachmim is, it's measured, but it's not as measured as din. It's kindness and measurement combined, right? The third way, and what does that mean? That means Avram couldn't be maimid yud beis shvatim, because whenever you're on one side, all the way at the edge, you're not the derech hamamutza. You can't be. It's not nuanced. It's not iterative. It's not. It's not balanced. You have to get it to get to Yaakov, right? Yaakov padas Avram. He takes the chesed and he measures it. You have to start off that way. Yitzchak din pure din. Ein oylem eskayim bedin. Shitefim em bidas harachamim. But you have to have it to get the rachamim. You can't have rachamim without going through chesed and din. But something, it's all the way on the other side. It's all the way on tzad smol din. Rachamim is where you say, let's be nuanced. Let's measure carefully. And why is it? Where do you see that in today's days? Avram, Yitzhak, and Yaakov, they're living with us, but it's long ago, right? You see, I saw this week in Satmar, children dressed up like Holocaust survivors. Like people in the concentration camp, two fat kids dressed up like in the concentration. There was nobody fat in the concentration camps. The marching, holding the Israeli flag, that it's equivalent. And you know what? We all agree there's problems in Israel, but to compare it to the concentration camps, it's just crazy. It's not nuanced. It's meshuggah. It's off the charts. It's fanatical, right? And we see that every day. You know, we see fanatics to the left, we see fanatics to the right, and you know what? Fanaticism is there is an element of it that maybe we can get from it, but it's nishnamal. And what does it mean? The memches drachim shatayrus niknus b'hem, which start We leave Pesach as slaves. We were ignorant. And the path to be makabel the Torah, the path to Das, the path to enlightenment, what does it say? There's going to be three parts to it. You're going to be inspired one way. You're going to be inspired the other way. And you know what? The last third, Yaakov Chevel Nachlasai, the Chotam Sholosh, that is when you can take the left and the right and balance it and Zayin Nomal, right? That is the real end of the journey towards Das, towards, you know, the Rambam writes, the Derech HaMamutza. So we have 16 days and we have 16 days, Lev. And Lag BaOmer means the last part of this trip. It says, take all these Memches Tvarim and use them in a normal and balanced way. And I said over a story a while ago, you know, I'll tell you, share with you two stories. I was sitting with somebody, a friend of mine last night, and his father died when he was 18. And he said, you know, when I was in yeshiva, we spoke about everything, learning, davening. He said, nobody ever spoke about to me about what does it feel like not to have a father. So when we take Torah, Torah is meant to be to use it, but to use it in a balanced way. I said over a story a while ago. So you have this fellow. He's cleaning for Pesach. Good erlich guy, mamish. And somebody knocks on the door, and he opens the door, and it's a collector, it's a schlepper, and he says, could you give me some food? I'm hungry. He says, I'm cleaning the house for Pesach. I didn't know, when did you even clean your pockets? Don't come, I'm sorry, I can't. Tries to slam the door, and the guy says, listen, I'm telling you, I'm starving. I didn't eat in 3 days. I can't now, I'm telling you, I'm focused on. So he says, I'm not leaving. So the guy says, he has no brera. So he ran into the kitchen, and luckily in the garbage, they hadn't thrown out the garbage yet, there was a loaf of moldy fish, gefilte fish, from Purim. So he runs out to the guy, he says, look, this is the last piece of something, have some chametz, take it out of the house with you and eat it. And he slams the door, and he looks out the window, and the guy gobbles the fish up, but it was moldy fish. And suddenly he sees the guy start vomiting and retching, and he's pounding on the pavement, and then he goes, phew, comatose. Comatose, oh my goodness, runs to the garage, pulls out his minivan, grabs the guy, pulls him into the minivan, takes him to the hospital, to the emergency room. 2 days later, he goes visit the guy. He's declining. He's in critical care. A day later, he hears he died. Runs to the Levaya, goes to be Menachem Avil. A few days later, this guy's wife sees him, and he says, Reb Zalman, tell me, like, or Reb Chaim, tell me, why are you so, you see me, his wife says to him, you see so besimcha today. He said, I am besimcha. She says, why? He says, just imagine, with one piece of fish, how many mitzvahs could you do? I was mekayim with a piece of fish. Hachnasas archim. I was mekayim hatzala, mitzvahs hatzala, loitamid al damriacha. I was mekayim bikacholim. I was mekayim levayas hameis. And then nicham avelim. All such as chus, how many mitzvahs you can be mekayim with one piece of fish, right? So what does this mean? Avadet es memches dvarim shatayr niknis pem. That each one could be distorted, each one could be twisted, distorted, right? So what does it say? Yes, there's the first 32, the 33rd. When it's midas Yaakov, what does it mean? The balance. No. Giving just gefilte fish to a guy at the ice, that is not using the Torah appropriately. By the carbonis, it says you need a reyach nichayach. It's not enough if there's a carbon, if the scent that comes from it is not a pure and a beautiful scent. If you are trying to confuse the smoke that came out of the smokestacks of Auschwitz, if you're lying on the floor, like we saw people saying, La Auschwitz v'loyle tzava, the followers of a certain Adam, right? That is not the Derech HaMamutza that is the message. So what is the message of Lag BaOmer? We're going towards Shavuos. We're going towards Kabbalah Satayra. Make sure that the Memches Dvarim leave you with a Reach Dichayach, a Derech HaMamutza, that something's beautiful, that when somebody looks at me or looks at you, what do they say? Baruch Aleikai Shimon Ben Shatach. I think that is a beautiful message for Lag BaOmer. Let's go to our guests.
We have on the phone with us from Lakewood, New Jersey, Rabbi Eli Bone. He's a musmach of Rav Belsky Zecharon Levracha, a Talmud of Rav Shlaima Miller. He's a Magid Shir and Yeshivas Meir HaTalmud. He He's also, for many years, the author and the editor of the column Halacha Brura. Welcome, Rabbi Bohm.
Thank you very much for having me.
Rabbi Bohm, we're doing a program, a shiur about Sheitlach, and we're curious as to, you know, you wrote about it extensively. What it was Rabbi Belsky's opinion? Walk us through some of what working on this issue has sort of been megala to you, both from the Metzias and from Halacha.
Sure. So I wrote on this topic, I would say it's probably close to 15 years ago, but just as an introduction, I once heard a quote of B'Shem Rishlaim Zalman in a few places where he mentioned that many of these tumults, if you want to call it, that affect the halachic world have about a 10-15 year life cycle, where many of the same tumults resurface every 10 to 15 years with some minor changes. In Sheitlach in particular, the Shiloh was first raised like in the 70s, I believe. And at that time, it was presented to many of the Gedali Yisrael, including Rabbi Moshe Feinstein, Rabbi Shlomo Zalman. And at that time, even Rav Eliashiv held that it was permitted. It resurfaced again about 15 years later, and then again probably about another 15 years later. So you really see the life cycle of this Shiloh. Rav Eliashiv about 15 years ago.
There is nothing in writing from Rav Moshe about this, am I correct?
There is nothing in writing, but there's quite a number of Talmidim that I've spoken to then that have discussed the question with Rav Moshe. And Rav Moshe held, again, based on what was presented to him, that it's not a Avodah Zarah. So there's really two questions that need to be addressed here. Number one, the act that's performed there, does that act render the hear to Kribis Avodah Zarah, which is one of the categories of things done to an idol that make it forbidden? And B, does the hear that we actually get in our Sheitlach, even if we get Indian Sheitlach, does it actually originate from the temple, from the Beis Avodah Zarah or not? So those are really the two questions that have to be analyzed and looked into.
Okay, so start at the beginning.
So when I delved into the question about 15 years ago, I was in touch both very much with Rabbi Belsky, who made his opinion very clear based on research that he's done and people who he's spoken to, including, which we'll touch upon, many Bali Tuva and Gerim that were part of this Hindu religion and actually were part of these services and were offering their recollection and their understanding on how it's done. In addition, I was in touch with Diane Dunner from England, who was sent down b'shlichus by Rav Eliashiv and by other Gedalim Menei Yisrael to actually go to India and research on his own and bring back his recollection. In analyzing, and Diane Dunner Shlichus, let me just emphasize on this, was primarily on discovering whether the act itself is Avodah Zarah. He didn't touch upon the latter question, whether the here itself originates. While there are others that did research, or perhaps maybe he himself did research at a later time, but his original Shlichus was really to come to an understanding whether the act is Avodah Zarah. So in getting some type of basic, without getting too complicated, Hilchas Avodah Zarah, and when I delved into it, it's one of these topics that there really aren't too many people that you could speak to about, because it's an obscure topic that even when people are learning Maseches Avodah Zarah, they really don't get into the nitty-gritties of it. And just for me, being a Talmid by Rabbi Belsky, it was an amazing for me to see how you were able to talk to him even early on, before he really this topic became popular, how fluent he was with every nuance in the sugya of Avodah Zarah, the same way as he was familiar with Hilchos Shabbos and the like. And not only in the sugya of Avodah Zarah, I spent quite some time doing research on the topic. Somebody once walked into my room when I was researching it, and he had the impression that, like, he asked me if I was converting religions because my desk was full of articles on the Hindu religion.
Okay.
And
so tell me, so what did you discover?
So familiar with that.
So what did you discover?
So the question really comes down, the crux of the question is as follows. In order for something to be considered tekred avodah zarah, that's when you're giving a gift to the avodah zarah. Now, just giving a gift to the avodah zarah doesn't necessarily make it forbidden unless it's a gift that was actually given in the Beis HaMikdash, such as meat, oil, and the like. If you're giving a gift to the avodah zarah, something that was not given in the Beis HaMikdash, it has to resemble one of the Maisei Avodah that was done in the Beis HaMikdash. So one of the Maisei Avodah was Shechita. And the Gemara says that if you go ahead and you do any cutting action or even a breaking action, that resembles Shechita. So let's say you break a stick in front of the avodah zarah, that, and you give the stick to the avodah zarah. So you, A, broke it in front of the avodah zarah, and you gave it to the avodah zarah. That makes that stick forbidden as the Krebs avodah zarah. So in part of this Hindu belief, there's a temple, the Tirupati temple, which is located on a mountain in India. There's about 50,000 pilgrims that go there daily. Now, part of their service, or I shouldn't say service, part of, because that's the question we need to analyze if it's a service, but part of the activities that they perform there, there's a barbershop, quite a number of barbershops there. The main barbershop has about 25,000 people daily attending, where they would either shave off their entire heads or just a few locks of head of their head, and then from that point they go to a ritual bath, and then they wait online to actually pass through their idol. And the question is, when they're removing their hair, why are they removing it? So Rybelski and myself, we've spoken to quite a number of Bali Tshuva and Gerim on the topic, and Diane Dunner went down there to analyze this question. Diane Dunner spoke to a few people when he was there, and they mentioned that they're offering it to the hair to their avodah zarah. So the question was, here there's a cutting action. They're cutting the hair. They're offering it to their avodah zarah, and they're doing it by the temple mount. So does that classify these three categories? A, it's in front of the avodah zarah. B, it's cutting it, and they're giving it as a gift to the avodah zarah. So Diane Dunner needed to analyze, number one, is this called in front of the avodah zarah? So the barbershop is actually not in the same location where the main temple is, although it's on the mountain. It's in a whole separate area and a separate building of it. But he got the feeling that the entire temple mount is one big base avodah zarah, because there are all different types of rituals being done on that temple mount. And there was others that disagreed with that point, saying that doesn't constitute it lufnei avodah zarah. So that's the first question. Is it lufnei avodah zarah? But more importantly, when they're cutting the hair, many of them told him that they're offering it to their avodah zarah. Rabbi Belsky spoke to, and from my research, quite a number of Bali Tshuva and Geirim, and they mentioned that it's not a gift that they're actually giving to avodah zarah. The process involves a removing something that represents a level of vanity, a level of gaiva, and here it's considered, while it's on someone's head, a big act of gaiva, that somebody has beautiful hair on their head. So by actually cutting the hair off your head, you are relinquishing that level of ego, that level of gaiva that's attached. And
even though the websites do say that there's a whole story that this avodah zarah lost the hair in the middle of his head and he wanted the hair back, and this other avodah zarah came and made magic and the hair grew back in the middle of his head. So it does seem at some level that it's considered an offering from the avodah zarah when you read the story that precedes it.
So there's so many versions of the stories that are put up there. The overwhelming majority of the stories that I've read.
This is the story basically on the main website. There's some deity that got bald in the middle of their head and was very traumatized by becoming bald, which is something that a lot of American males, which is why, you know, the old, you know, snake oil salesman is where we get that metaphor from. And the avodah zarah got traumatized, and it was clearly before Propecia or hair transplants or whatever. So this other Avodah Zarah came, and because that's where this website says it stems from. So even if it's sacrificing of the vanity, it does seem there is an element of the Avodah Zarah missing its hair.
Just so,
it's definitely missing the hair.
The question is missing the hair, so I'm giving replenishing your hair, or missing your hair, so therefore my act of somewhat atonement is that I need to resemble that Avodah Zarah by having myself be missing here as well.
Okay.
And that's what the Bali Tshuva and the Gerim really felt. And one thing, one point they mentioned, that it's illogical for anyone who knows the basics of that religion to say that they're actually giving it to the Avodah Zarah, because here in their religion, it's considered one of the most Tamei Dika items. And they work with a class system of a hierarchy. The people who are very low down on that chain are the barbers, and the people even lower than that are the people who collect the hair, because they're somewhat getting contaminated by touching the hair. So they said it would be completely illogical for someone who understands the religion to say, here I'm taking the thing that's the most dabur tameh and giving it as a present to the Avodah Zarah. It's something that will be like an insult to the Avodah Zarah. What's really happening is they're removing the hair in front of the Avodah Zarah in order, whether they want to resemble the Avodah Zarah losing his hair, or they want to remove their vanity in front of the Avodah Zarah, but they're not really giving it as a gift. And also part of the question is, the one who's doing the mice of cutting aren't the people, it's the barbers. So what's more importantly is, the question is, the barbers, are they intending to be doing a maisa of abdus of Avodah Zarah while they're cutting the hair? And that's an important point, because the guy who's getting the haircut, he could have whatever intent he's needed.
We have to start fahering the barbers and asking them their intent.
Exactly. So when Dayan Dunner himself admitted, when he went down there, he said, most of the barbers, they were involved in idle chit-chat. They're talking politics. They're cracking jokes with each other. And he asked them, like, why did they do it? So one guy said, because we get paid. So even...
You have to ask Feher, each barber, and ask him what his stam al-shma is. Why is he going to work?
Exactly.
And is it really a sacrifice? So
exactly.
So the issues are really multiple. First of all, so let's talk about it. Let's say the Bali Tshuva are right, or whoever you spoke to is right, and the service is really not sacrificing the hair, which is an if, right?
Correct.
But let's assume they're right. But the barbers and the people who are coming in front are Amaratzim, right? And they think that the service is cutting the hair. What would be the halacha then?
So first we would have to determine if that's what they all think. One thing which was interesting, even when Dayan Dunner spoke to many of them, there's various different dialects, and he had interpreters. And some of the Bali Tshuva and the Gerim pointed out, when they use the word offer or they use the word accept, they're not really referring to an offer as a gift. Like when we say Hashem accepts our tefillos, that doesn't necessarily mean that we gave him something. It's something that he was pleased with our tefillos. When they're offering something, it could be that they're relinquishing something to Avodah Zarah, not necessarily giving it. So that's something you have to really understand what the feeling is on the ground. But if, let's say, the barbers are essentially doing it, and despite their fact that their priests are saying, this is not the Avodah Zarah, this is not the way you worship it, this became like a new cult of how they're worshiping the Avodah Zarah based on their Amaratzis, quite possibly it would become usher on that point. The question really
and from what I understand from Rav Belsky's letter that I wrote, he seems to imply that what Rabbi Dunner was machadish, is that notwithstanding that the Kaimrim, that their priests may believe one thing, the vast majority of these people are Amaratzim, and they're doing it for other reasons. So that was my understanding from what Rabbi Belsky is writing here. He says, look, that was Dayan Dunner's chiddush. What changed in the 17 years from Ramesh's psak is the fact that he wasn't aware. But here's something that I find very interesting, neither Rabbi Yashiv, and I went through his letters, nor Rabbi Belsky really work on, I think, what's the critical point here, and that is, who's koveya what it is service Havayda Zara? Let's say somebody does something that's absolutely, you know, erroneous, and the Havayda is one thing, and he's totally doing something absurd. Well, is that Havayda Zara or not? And there don't seem to be any proofs to that topic.
Right, right. Quite possibly is if a religion is started, and that can be started by individuals, where this becomes the way to be to perform it, and they realize that this might have not been the intent, but they're doing it because they feel this is what they need for the Avodah Zarah. That perhaps could become like a new religion of Avodah Zarah. But if
hello,
really
but they're making a mistake.
They're completely my
question to you is, this is not something we could sit here and pontificate about. This is where you need a Raya Gedolah from Rishonim. What is Kaveya? So let me attempt to bring a few Rayas, right? The Rambam, which seems to be the core point. Like Dayan Dana said, well, since they're making a mistake, it's Avodah Zarah. And Rabbi Belsky said, well, I don't believe they're making a mistake, it's the Kaimrim. Well, let's say he's right. So they were wrong, and he's saying that's Avodah Zarah. If you look at the Rambam in Hilchos Avodah Zarah, right away in Perek Gimel, the Rambam's pretty clear that the what's Keveya, what's Avodah Zarah, is that not any single individual. Rambam's Lashon is, let me read the exact Lashon here, let me find it. Harbe Avodah Tiknu, L'Shar Tzlamim, L'Ficha Chapoyer Atzmi, L'Mar Kol, Shavikar L'Poyer, Pater Ad She'yavid Oisei, Derech Avodasei. So it's they made many different services, and the avoid has to be derech avoidase, the way he served. Shenemer echa yavdu gaim also hey and vesekein gamani umipneze inyan srichem bezdin lei that darki avoid shein soikor evchamachedu shezuhi derech avoidase. So there's something called the derech of its avoid, and if you come and you do your own derech avoida, it wouldn't really it wouldn't make a difference. So there's if you look in the avoidas hamelach over there. He says, he brings a story, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, by a Nachris that was very sick. And she said, so when she came to Baal Pa'or, she asked the Kaimrim, and that's how she served it. So the Lashon of the Gemara is, Sha'alah l'Kaimrim. So you have to know, what is the Derech Avodasa? So if you come and you're an Amaretz, and you do the wrong Avodah, the Rambam would seem to imply it's not. And there are other Rayas. For example, there's the famous Gemara where somebody went to Baal Pa'or, the Gemara in Sanhedrin, I think it's with Safta ben Alas. He wanted to make fun of Baal Pa'or, so he defecated in front of Baal Pa'or, and then he cleansed himself on the face of the Avodah Zarah. And the Gemara says that even though he meant to be Mavazit, he was Ovid Avodah Zarah because the Kaimrim said, wow, what a perfect Avodah he did. His intent was to make fun of it, but in effect he was making an Avodah, so his intent didn't matter. What mattered is this was what the Kaimrim considered its Derech Avodah. So my question would be is, with all this tumult, I haven't seen anybody focus on what is the core question is, can a bunch of ignorant people come ahead and say, this is how we're serving it, and if they're all wrong, is that indeed Avodah Zarah?
So that's why I mentioned before, if the people would go ahead and essentially be starting their own new religion and saying this becomes Derech Avodasai, then quite possibly it's a new religion.
But not if it's against,
it's not a new religion.
They're
exactly.
going to the same Kaimrim.
Exactly.
So is there
exactly.
any Raya that if somebody comes and they do something absolutely incorrect, even if it's a lot of people, that it has a din of Derech Avodasai? And if it's not, does it have any meaning?
Correct. And so that's why I mentioned earlier, and my feeling was, and the Lashon Rambam, as you indicated, does imply that, where a person is just an Amaretz, and he's not really looking to start a new Derech Avodah Zarah. He's doing something Shloike Derech Avodah Zarah that doesn't make it to be Avodah Zarah. Clearly, by Tekrivus Avodah Zarah, it has to be Derech Avodah Zarah in order for it to become Aser, because it has to resemble the Beis HaMikdash, and it has to be something that this is something that's either Derech HaVedasai or something that's utilized in front of the Avodah Zarah in a different way. So if I would go ahead and break a stick, but the breaking the stick is not Derech Avodasai, but I utilize a stick for the Avodah Zarah in a different way, that would still make it to be forbidden. But this here is not utilized in the Avodah Zarah in any other way, so it would have to be Derech Avodasai in order for it to be Asar.
Okay, and what else? Tell us some of these.
I feel that way, that it's the Kaimrim that establish it, again, unless you're starting a new religion, which doesn't seem to be the case, and definitely not the barbers. They're definitely not looking to start a new religion.
Okay, and when it's so Rabelski held it was mutter. Now, those Talmidim of Reb Moshe, like, did they say, did he give reasons why? Like, what was Reb Moshe's logic?
The logic then was based on again, the feeling and the reports that they received that this doesn't constitute Tekarebis Avodah Zarah. Now, those who disagreed claimed the information now changed. There's new information on the ground because we went down and we interviewed people. While there's others that said, if somebody who goes down is not well-versed in religion, for example, if let's say you'd go Matzah Shabbos in front of a shul and you see many people standing out saying Kiddush Lavana, and you're not really familiar with the practice, you'd walk away saying, hey, the Jews worship the moon. But we know that that's not the case. So you really need to be somewhat familiar with the religion before someone goes down there and starts delving into it. And the Bali Tshuva and the Gerim that were familiar said this is the furthest thing. This goes against the basic principles of the religion because here is something that is a Davar Tamei, and it doesn't make sense that they'll be giving that as a gift. And then there really is the second point. Does our here actually come from the temple? So an important aspect there is, without getting too detailed into the here business, and I did research both based on the import and exports of the invoices that there were performed and the countries that were buying the here and the like. There's various different grades of here. There's something called Remi here. What Remi here is, when here is cut, when here is on someone's head, there's various different layers that the here has. The outer layer is the cuticle layer. Now, when you cut off here, let's say it falls down in a barbershop on the floor, and it gets all mixed up, that here gets completely tangled. And the only way that you could turn that into any product, you got to soak that here into an acid bath, which removes the outside cuticle layer. And then you start processing the hair, and you could turn it into a hair extension, a wig, a toupee, or anything else of that sort. Here needs to be processed. Is called Remi here. And what Remi's here, Mila, is when they remove the hair, they cut the hair, they put a ribbon on, let's say, the long hair, they cut it off completely, maintaining the alignment of the direction of where the hair is. So the hair doesn't get all tangled by the cuticles, each pointing in a different direction. In the temple, they sell the hair as Remi here because they're being cut off in a barbershop and they're taking here while they're cutting off to maintain that alignment. And that's a very, very expensive here. Here that you get elsewhere is not classified as that expensive grade of Remi here. Now, part of the research that was done, the price that the temple is selling the here is way above the price that countries like China and Korea that process the here, which most of our Indian shaitels come from, they're actually not processed in India, they're processed in China, Korea, are purchasing the hair from, which would imply that the market that they're getting it from is not the temple market. And the overwhelming majority of hair that's exported from India is actually not from the temple. It's from barbershop droppings, or there's some people in India that have like a phobia that after the hair is cut, they don't throw it out into the garbage because they're afraid that somebody who knows them will get a hold of their hair and use that as a way to cast a spell against them. So they just give it away as a gift to someone, some organization that doesn't know them, or they sell it. That hair is a much cheaper grade hair. Now, it actually is logical that our hair doesn't come from the temple, because most Jewish shaitels are not naturally black. They're brown. They're more of a blondish color. There are other colors. There's very few Yidden. It's just part of our genes that have a very black Indian type of hair color. So our hair has to be processed anyway in order to dye it and change the colors. So experts in the hair industry said it doesn't make sense. Why would they buy high quality hair, which the mile of that here is that it's good as is, does not have to be processed, and then go ahead and kill the hair by having to dye it and process it. So most of the India hair goes to hair extensions that people who have that color hair will go ahead and implant in their heads, which is very popular in the African American community. In Hollywood, they're buying a lot of wigs, people who need toupees.
Bottom line is your research says that this is not the hair that we're using.
Exactly. So even if this is Advaita Zara, it wouldn't necessarily relate to our Indian hair that we're getting. It just wouldn't make sense that for them to get it from and pay that premium dollar for hair that they're going to have to ruin anyway. And the purchase invoices indicate that the countries, China and Korea, that are buying the Indian hair are paying way less than the price that the temple is selling the hair for.
Well, Rabbi Bohm, we could go on for hours, and we may have to call
yes.
you back depending on what the other people say, but this was fascinating, and we very much enjoyed it, and thank you for your time and the research you put into it.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure being on the air.
Kulta, bye-bye.
We have with us Priest Krishna Acharya of the Hindu
yes.
Temple and Cultural Society of the USA, a Sri Venkateswara Temple and Community Center. Welcome, Priest Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Priest, I have a question. We have the famous hair tantering that happens in the Tirumala Temple. Can you explain to us what is the purpose of the hair shaving of the head, the hair tantering?
Okay. Actually, we have a 16 rituals in our life, from birth to death. In that 16, this is the called hair offering. It will be also called as a mundan in Hindi language. It will be do the first time near God. First time means when a child was born in 1 year, not after 1 year, first 1 year, we have to do this recital near God. Means the egoness don't come to my life. Who is performing? Who is the hair cutting is going to perform to a child? The ego never comes to my life. So the ego is offering to Lord's feet. Means ego never comes in my life. That is the main thing what we are doing, shaving of whole head and whole head. Yeah, that's the first from the birth to it will be due on 10th month and the child was born. If the boy born in January, we have to do this type of function on 10th month, means October.
Priest, you said it's about ego, egoness?
Ego means selfishness.
So priest, why do we cut our hair off to show that we're not going to be selfish?
The hair replicates the egoness, told our Shastra, told my, the Hindu religion Shastras told. The head means we have to bow our head near the God's feet. So head means that selfishness. Okay, the replica of selfishness is our head. When we bow the head and when we cut that hair on head, that indicates we have removing all our selfishness near God. Then God shows us a proper way to how to become a good man. in the universe. He teach us to how to elaborate ourselves, how to respect each other's. She teaches us like that. So we have the replica of egoness, the replica of selfishness, that hair. When we remove that hair, we are removing our selfishness, our ego, our everything near God.
Priest, is the there's another service, and it's called Tul Abraham. Right, when they serve, bring sugar, candy, sugar, rice, in the weight of the person. Am I pronouncing it correctly? Tulbraham, could you explain? Is that is that different? Is that different than tonsuring the hair, cutting the hair?
Yes, that is different because that is the not in the. I already told to you in the beginning, there is a 16 rituals from our birth to death.
Right.
In that 16, there is no Tulabharam. You are calling Tulabharam means that is actually when we are praying to God. If you give something to me, I will give something to you. That is the offering position. That is the offering. If our child wants something, expecting something from us, means if you finish this homework, I will give one donut to you or something. If you finish this work, I will give something. This is
right.
this is our regular journey. Same type of feeling with God also. If you give us to good wealth, I will give something.
So
if you give
Tul Abraham like a gift to God?
Yes, Tulabharam. That calls Tulabharam.
Tulabharam is a gift to God, and the hair tonsuring is the removal of selfishness and ego. Not a gift to God, but the removing of selfishness and ego. Is that correct?
Correct. Yes, exactly.
Priest, thank you very much for your time. We appreciate it mostly.
No problem. I think if you are satisfied my answers.
Yes, your answers, we understood them very well. Thank you. You said that there's
a
difference. Yes, you said Tul Abraham is a sacrifice and a gift to God, and the hair tonsuring is removal of selfishness and ego, type of humbleness.
Correct.
Thank you very much, priest.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. We have on the phone with us Rav Leizer Pashkes from the Kleisenberger Kollel in Muncie, who has written and has discussed and spoken about the topic of the human hair sheitlach. He's researched it extensively, spoken to many rabbonim, etc. Welcome, Harav Leizer.
Shalom and bracha. It's
Harav
a pleasure to be on.
Okay, I'm sorry.
It is a pleasure to be here today with you to shine a little light about this Indian hair topic that has been refreshed around the old Yiddish communities right now.
Okay, so Rabbi Leizer, could you tell us what has your research and your going around to Talmidei Chachamim and Rabbanim and Rebbes and Dayanim, what has it, give us a little bit, share us a little bit of your knowledge.
Okay, I'll go back with a chapter in the history throughout the last 8-9 months that I'm involved in this. It was towards the end of the summer, actually getting closer to the Chodesh Elul last year, when I heard people talking about this topic, that it's not so pashit that the sheitels that are going around in the Yiddish market are as kosher as people think. And being that my wife is a sheitelmacher, Baruch Hashem, for 12 years now, it was very, very interesting me to know if the line that I am in is proper and kosher 100%, and if this is what I'm allowed to give people and make money on. So as I was getting closer in the research, I contacted some of the wig makers that I did business with during the past years. There's actually a friend of mine who lives in Muncie. He had at a certain point his own line of shetels. That means he goes down to a certain factory and he runs his own company. And throughout the years, he used to tell me, Laser, why don't you do it yourself? That way you can make like 100% markup on it or even more. It's just it doesn't pay to give money to the companies that are doing it. You can do it yourself. So now was the time that I contacted him, and I wanted to ask him, tell me, what's going on over here? I heard people saying, it's not so posh, the shetels are coming from India, it could be not coming. Tell me, where do you get your stuff? I know you know it. So it tells me that he has a factory in Korea where he goes down, and over there he makes his run of several thousands of shetels, and this is what he brings into the Hamish market. So I asked him, where does the hair come from? His answer on that was a question mark. He doesn't know. But something I can tell you, that I have a mashkiach, he has a hechsher, and he comes down, and he has his ways of finding out, and he knows that. But I asked him again, tell me, you're in the line for so many years, and you are there in Korea. Do you know the truth where it is from? He told me no. Okay, that was the end of that. Actually, he did explain me how the hechsher works, which that is a different point, if we can go into it maybe at a later point. So, at the same time, I called a different company. I asked them, that's a well-known company in Brooklyn, and they supply shetels like thousands and thousands to the whole market in America. I think maybe they sent to Eretz Yisrael also. I asked them, from where is your hair from? He told me, oh, we have Mongolian hair. Okay, so I have some type of lead. Knowing that there is something called Mongolian hair, I went online and tried to find out. Is there something? How many do they produce? So I saw, yes, there is a country next to China, and this is called Mongolia, and that's what the people claim from where they have their hair. I was trying to see, are there any exporters from Mongolia? I couldn't find anyone from Mongolia selling hair. Actually, at a later time, when I went into the UN Comtrade to see the actual exports from each land, I punched in exports from Mongolia for years 2015, 16, and 17, it came up zero. No exports from Mongolia going out. As I was researching further on this, I did find a company. It's called IndiaMart. It's actually like an Amazon company based in India, which they have deal with several suppliers and different products. So I saw them selling Mongolian hair. So I gave myself in as I am a wig maker. I want to make wigs. Can you sell me some Mongolian hair? So he tells me, sure, I'll sell you. How much do you want? He gave me a whole list of all his types and sizes and colors. You name it, we give it to you. So as I was going in an email discussion back and forth, I asked him, and I'll read the email exactly that I have in front of me. From where is your stock? So he answered, hi, we have 100% raw temple here, unprocessed. There are one donor donated here. If you want, you can check quality by sample order. Okay, so I asked him back, why are they called Mongolian here? So this is what he answered me. My friend, looking forward to become your trusted supplier. To begin the long association, I would begin by honestly informing you that Brazilian and other Oregon here do not exist. Since buyers ask for these here, we too have to use such names and sell. It is a farce to claim authentic Brazilian and other hair being made in India or China. All hair are Indian. We inform every buyer truthfully that the origin of all hair is Indian. However, over the years, we have started making some variations in manufacturing so that hair could be sold as Brazilian, etc., etc. And then he goes on explaining why each type of hair gets a different name according to the quality of it and the length and the body. I understood this discussion to him as someone.
Well, let me ask you a question.
Yes, sir.
You went on the UN site and it showed where the breakdown of hair is, right?
Yes.
And which countries, give me some of the countries that the U.S. brings as exporters of hair.
I didn't check all companies, all countries. I did check the only few that I heard that they are and that the wig makers are making over there. So the first one was I checked actual India itself, and there's you need to know how to put it in because there are a few different codes to put in over there. So the only code that people would use is 6703. That code reads...
My question is China. Do they have here from China?
So here goes a big part of what was a mix-up between 14 years ago and now. Yes, there are very, very, very much here in China.
Right.
But when looking at India's exports, you see the majority, like 80, 85% of hair exported from India goes straight to China. I actually have that in front of me.
But the UN is talking about countries that manufacture, quote-unquote, hair. So, in other words, if India sells it to China and then China sells it to the U.S. and the U.S. sells it to Korea, they're not going to count that hair four times. So they count Indian exports, China exports, et cetera, et cetera. So my question is, what other countries besides India did you see on the UN list?
I saw several countries. There's India and there is China, Brazil, a slight amount for Russia. But again, all these numbers, as you said.
You're saying when the UN says that Brazil is manufacturing here or exporting here, do you think that they're lying to us?
Oh, so let me explain it to you. There is no way of tracking exactly to follow the trail through the UN Comtrade website to see if they are calculating again the same hair that came into China and that went out to China. There's no way of tracking that. You can just see a general amount of hair exported from India going to China. And then there's also an amount of hair exported from China going to the world, to different countries. You can put in whatever you want. But there's no way of knowing if this is the same hair they are talking about or not.
Well, why didn't you ask that to the fellow at the UN who made up the chart? What is he basing it on?
They just keep track of the imports and export of every country. So I believe they themselves don't have a way of tracking that.
So it could be the same hair that sold four times and each country is now being counted.
Exactly. And that was part of the mix-up.
We'll speak to the UN and we'll find out if that's the case.
Exactly. So I was just explaining that in the years that, 14 years ago, people also made these calculations through the UN, and that's why they came out that the hair exported from India is just a myth, because they were comparing it, the hair from India, versus hair from all other countries, without taking into consideration whatever you just mentioned.
What percentage of Indian hair comes from the temple?
That doesn't say. I haven't found that anywhere. We just tried to make that calculation.
Did you hear the interview with the professor from the University of London who wrote the book about hair?
Yes, I did.
And she said it's a small percentage of the hair in India comes from temples.
Okay. So her statement was based a lot on the owner of the Gupta company, whatever he told her, that he buys just a small amount from the temples. Now,
did you read her book?
Parts of it, yes.
So she has around 40 or 50 different interviews there. So it's not just from the guy from the Gupta temple. I mean, she spent 30 years researching here, right?
Yes. In her book, she contradicts several times. I don't have it in front of me to show that exactly where that is. But it seems that she is very biased in her book, and she's really making fun of the Rabbanim. And she also claims that she has real mercy on the Indian people. She doesn't want them to lose their business. So, therefore, she was turning around some information. Now, people did ask this question. Yes, there's someone, Professor Amitalo, in her book Entanglement, she claims that only a small percent comes from the temples. I have a question to these people. From where does the rest come from?
Well, she said exactly where it comes from, not from temples. People sell the hair.
Yes, so according to the numbers that we have from the temple itself, it really, really adds up to give approximately 80, 85 or more percent of the hair coming out from India is from the temples.
Well, we had on Rabbi Kuber, who said that it's exactly between 12 and 15% comes from Tirupati Temple compared to the annual exports that India reports to the UN. So how do you explain this contradiction?
So the contradiction goes like this. He made his base that the only temple selling hair is Tirupati. Am I correct with that?
That's the 12% was from Tirupati, yes.
So he claimed that the Tirupati was the only temple selling hair. Now,
he didn't
wherever
say
you...
He said the 12% Tirupati's annual thing, and it's by far the largest one, he said, is 12%. That's the tantrum capital of the world. Out of 100%, it's 12%, correct?
Okay, so according to the numbers that I added up, there is on the website from the actual Tirupati temple, they make monthly auctions on that, and they have exact amounts, whatever they sell. I added that up, and it came out to me to be, I don't have the percentages right now. So in their auction they had, it's on their website, dated January 4th, they're saying the monthly auction, and they include the categories 1, 2, and 3, this was the what Rabbi Kuber was mentioning, that itself, if you multiply that by 12, that means for the whole year, that would come out itself to 1,000 kilograms. I'm sorry, I mean it's 1,000 tons. Now, on the Indian export itself, through the UN Comtrade, they have 2,781 ton for the whole of India. Now, that, to me, is something like a third, not 12%. And that is only from this Tirupati.
So he had different numbers. I'll share your numbers with him, and we'll see what he responds. But he had different numbers. Maybe you're using 1 month, but he had very different. But we'll gladly share your numbers with him.
Okay, and that is focusing only at the Tirupati temple. Now, we have found, if you do a Google search in India for hair exporters in India, there are approximately, you'll have 75% of exporters are next to the temple. That means 34 out of 46 hair exporters are based near the temples. Now, when we're looking at temples, it's a big mistake to think that only Tirupati is the seller of hair. There are many, many, many temples over there. I actually have a printout from the Economic Times where they interviewed a hair trader from Bhavani Enterprises, and he claims he does business with several other temples. I read like this, temples in Tamil Nadu and Andhra Pradesh are the major sourcing centers for such hair. And then he says also, this report is from 2013. Now hear what he says. We have increased our sourcing by 7 to 10% from temples as salon hair. Yes, because there were other source. One of the sources of hair that used to be was from salons.
Can I ask you a question,
yes.
Rabbi Pashkas?
Mm-hmm.
We're arguing over a mitzias, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'll take your numbers. I'll give them to Rabbi Kuber. We'll call this woman. If you agree that it's a small minority, so for you, does the Shiloh go away? Like, I'm not going to sit here. We have somebody that spent 30 years in there. She said she knows all the numbers. This guy researched the numbers. You have different numbers. Okay, let's assume for a minute that they're right and it's a small minority. It's 15%. It's 20%. So do all your issues go away?
No, they do not. But I would like
We'll get to the bottom of the numbers. I'm not an accountant. We'll have somebody go through, an analyst go through whose numbers are right. Zolzide, are you done? Is that the end?
So, first of all, there was Rabbi Yashiv's psak that he held that time that even if it's a miut, there's
Rabbi
still
Yashiv
the halacha.
Rabbi Yashiv writes it. 75% of the hair comes from the temple in his psak. Right, just for the record.
Yes.
So this is what he was told, right? 75%. And then he writes that, continue, because I know the psak, continue.
Okay.
So if he was given wrong information, and it's not 75%, but 25%, continue.
In his discussion, it came out, Rabbi Moshe Moshe Karp wrote that in his letter, repeating it from Rabbi Yashiv, that even if it's a miyat, he had this chiddush that there's still a look of kol kavua kamech tal mechza on this, being that a goy is also mitzvah on bittul of the kreves of avodah zarah, so that doesn't help even if it's a miut. But even if you want to go it that way, for me this was also enough knowing, even if it is just a minority, if it would have been, this still is not something that I should be dealing with or people should be going with, because the halacha of kol deparish meruba parish, that is, even if it was told to say that it is only a mi'at, this is something when we're talking about someone has something already, that the halacha of teisha chanayah is if he got something already and needs to know if it's mutter or aser, then they could say kol deparish meruba parish. But for me, in my own business, I was not ready to continue giving out to people something that is just, even if it would have been just a mi'at, that is not a lechatchila b'chlal.
Okay, let's go through the shilas here. The first
okay.
shila is, what is the das of the person who's here is kari, being cut off, right? So do you agree that the authorities we spoke to say that certainly according to the koimerim of the religion, right, it's not supposed to be a takrevis. Here is something that's considered ugly, the way she said. It's something of nevala. It's disgusting. And so that's where the Kaimer Makaveya, what Rabbi Dana was Mechadish, is that may be what the Kaimer was saying, but it's the people have different thoughts. Do you agree with that or no?
Definitely not.
Okay. Let me hear.
The Kaimerim today that are saying that hair is a Dabar Tame, that is true. But the reason for the pantsering is not for taking off a Dabar Tame. And even if the reason they were saying 14 years ago that the reason for tantering is just for hachna, for degrading the person's own ego, halachically, this really does not make it not be the krevus of adisara. And I will explain.
Yeah.
Just like in every mitzvah, we have the halachas of a mitzvah, and there are the tamaya mitzvah.
Right.
For example, we slaughter a korban pesach. So there's a mitzvah, the dina, a mitzvah, how we're supposed to do it. And they are
right.
The Tamei HaMitzvah, which the Torah tells us, Al Shem Shepasach.
Right.
Now, if a person was to go, and why do I need to slaughter a Korban Pesach? I'll stand on the floor, I'll make a jump, I'll do it for myself, Al Shem Shepasach. That person wasn't the kind of the mitzvah, because
exactly.
The actual mitzvah, the fact of the mitzvah needs to be done how the Torah tells us. And then we have, like the Sefer HaKelech, that tells us the Tamei HaMitzvah. Now,
right.
With this tantering, we have Le'elef Alfa Avdolis. The action of tantering is called by them, it is a choshev avoda. They do it with a whole awe, and they go to it. And the reason behind it could be, possibly, for taking off, degrading the ego. I would be fine with holding that way. That would not help it making it not be tekrevis avoda zara.
Wait, tekrevis avoda zara, Rashi defined as a gift avoda zara. So if a person takes a shower to wash off his dirt, right, does the water become tekrevis avoda zara?
Definitely not.
So takrivis, exactly like you're saying, there's a gedder of what is takrivis. Takrivis has to be, it's a gift to the Avodah Zarah, it's a carbon for the Avodah Zarah. Something that is considered removing a davar tameh is not a gift. So according to your very mushel, it's like dancing by the carbon pesach and jumping. No matter what you're doing something that is not a takrivis. I don't understand your logic.
So here it goes, in Sima Kiflamates and Yeredeya, there are two types of Takrevis of Edizara. The Rashi you're quoting, the Rashi Yevamis, that is talking about something that is given as a Dairin and that does not need any Ken Zvicha or Ken Shvira or anything like that. Just by giving something as a gift, that would make it Takrevis of Edizara.
No.
Then comes the second part, there is in Siv Gimel Kiflamates, Shavar Makalifaneo, and how Rashi explains it, if the derech was by kishkish makel, then this doesn't need, it should be given to the halil.
But that's because it's derech.
One second. Just because by an action, the person doing an action of avoida, to avoida zara, that they believe that through this action, they're giving a nachas ruach for the getchka, this itself makes it a credit.
So let me ask you a question. If somebody got up in a Christian church, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they cut their hair off, right, for the same reason. Would you say it's a takrevis avodah zarah?
I'm not sure about that, but here goes that for the Christians it's not derech avodasa, and over here
right.
It is derech avodasa.
So the question is, what if the galachim are telling you it's not derech avodasa, and somebody would
That's
get up
true.
By a Christian church, and he said, well, we're going to have some more priests on the show. But so for every single one we've spoken to, I know that some people think they know better how the Hindus, what the Avodah is than the Hindus themselves. We've spoken to a number of priests, including a number of experts, and they say it's not Derech Avodah. So somebody would come to a church and shave their head off. Would you say that the here is now, because this person's doing it, L'shem Takrevis Avodah Zarah, is Takrevis Avodah Zarah?
So the question that we put for the priest to ask them if it's an Avodah, that is not by asking them what the reason they do it for. If you look at the people doing it, and even the priest hold that it is an Avodah, did the priest say this is not an Avodah?
The priests say very specifically on the program we will have this week, where they say it is not an Avodah. And we ask them, in fact, there's something else where they offer flowers and candies. They say that is a sacrifice, and this is not a sacrifice. This is a cleansing. They say it's Shachar al Gabi Lavan, and so did Rabbi Weissman say that last week, and so did Emmet Tarlow. So we're going to have another, I think, two priests say the same thing. So if a guy goes to a church in front of Isaiah Ish, and he shaves his head, would you say that's a takrevis avodah zarah? That's what I'm asking you.
So there it is not derech avodah zarah. It's very hard to go to explain for a priest what we would consider derech avodah zarah. So,
but it's very good to ask him what the intent is, and when he tells you, you know if it's derech avodah zarah. And he says,
so here goes. You're going back to the intention of that. We are not looking at the intention.
Is this a gift or is it not a gift? And they say, no, it is not a gift, it is a cleansing.
Even if it's not considered a gift, we still hold that as a Derech Avodah.
It's a mishing dietris. I know it's a mishing to Shulchan Aruch. The Shulchan Aruch says that and the Gemara in Avodah Zarah, I think, on Daf Nun Amid Beis, the Gemara says that an Avodah Zarah, that the Derech Avodah is Kishkish B'Makol, they bang drums in front of it, and everybody agrees. So if you then take that stick and break it, it's close enough to Derech Avodasa that it's considered a takrovis, or if Shavar Makel is close enough if they do another Avodah with it. But since in a church, right, nope, they don't have any Avodah of burning here, if you cut your hair, even according to the Mechaba, would not be Derech Avodasa. So since in a Hindu church, there is no, or a Hindu temple, there is no Avodah with the hair, that's what the Kaimrim say, if you shave your hair, even according to the Mechaba, it cannot, or according to Rashi, certainly on Nunam Beis, it can never become Derech Avodasa. So the only way to make it Derech Avodasa is to say, which is what Rabbi Dunna said. Even Rabbi Dunna didn't say that the priest that way, because he said, because we already have a psak from Reb Moshe and the first psak from Eliashiv that said it's not. He said, no, even though the priests don't, the people themselves do. But no, even what's happening now is that it's just like it's becoming absurd. What Rav Moshe and what Rav Eliashiv already passed, because they respected that if the Kaimrim should at least know their own Avodah Zarah what they're doing, is that he said, no, the people don't know what they're doing. Now you're coming to say, no, even the, I don't know what you're saying. You're saying the priests don't know what they're doing. What is the point you're making?
Let me explain it to you very clearly. The priests, when you ask them or someone asks them, is this considered an Avodah? Is this a gift or an offering? Could
they
will say no?
Is this a sacrifice to Avodah Zarah? That's what they ask.
Okay. Yeah. So in Rav Eliashiv's first Tshuva in Tovshin Nun, he writes there that he understood from the Kaimrim and the Mumchem that the actual tantring is not something davar choshev, and choshev Avodah by them. I'll explain it. Part of one of their customs is before they enter the tantra hall or the temple, they take off their shoes. Now, the reason for taking off the shoes is to show that self-sacrifice,
respect.
Showing humbilizing.
Respect,
exactly. Now, that taking off the shoes, would anyone consider that an Avodah?
I don't think so.
For sure not. Okay. So here goes the difference between taking off the shoes and taking off the hair. When a person travels, a Hindu person travels from his house to go to the temple, to Tirupati, or to all other temples out there, will he say, what am I going to do there? Am I going to take off my shoes? Don't talk about that. There's also another part of Hachana to the tantra. They take a bath. No one will consider the bath or taking off the shoes and avoid it because this is not considered something davar chashuv by them. But when a person goes to tantra, they consider that they're doing something, a special act to the god.
Exactly. What they're doing is they're sacrificing, they're taking their ego. They're removing their ego before they go in. Exactly.
But let me ask you, is this act of removing the ego, shaving the hair, is this considered by them a holy action?
Even if it's holy, it's not a gift to the god. It's not a takravis.
So here you're contradicting. Before we spoke about, even if it's not a gift, this is considered a derech haloida.
No,
you're saying
not.
That the priests are saying, you were saying, you were...
The priests do not consider it a derech avoda in front of the olil. For it to be a takravis, there has to be a similar avoda in front of the olil. So you're saying it's not even, you're saying removing the hair is not takravis, but it's actual avoda zara, you're saying. Nobody said that.
Saying,
even Rabbi Yashiv didn't write that. Rabbi Yashiv writes it's takravis. You're saying it's not takravis, it's actually a type of avoda.
Yes. That's the way Rabbi Yashiv held in Tafshin
Salafalot. But Rabbi Yashiv writes it's takravis. Takravis means is a separate sift. There's Avodah Zarah and there's Takravis. You're being Mechadish now that it's not only Takravis, but it's Avodah Zarah Atzma. You have a new Chiddush.
That's the halach of Kishkush Makel and Shavar Makel, that when a
Kishkush
person Makel does
is Derech, okay.
One second. When a person does any action for the Avodah Zarah, the thing, whatever he used to do this action, becomes Takravis Avodah Zarah. And that's what Rashi says. In the beginning of the Sechta Vaidazara, let me say, there's a Rashi by Daf Nun Aleph, Shabbatra Matchila Lekach. What does Rashi say over there? Rashi says, I'll quote Rashi, Shabbat Betzirasam Avda Lavaidus Trechovim. That means that the actual Betzira was considered deaning the Getchka, and that itself makes it for Takarevus Vaidazara. So going with that Rashi, and this is Pashtus, what it comes out from Kishkish Makel and Shavar Makel, which does not need any giving it as a doyer, as Rashi's quote says in Yevamos, this itself makes it for Takravis Avodah Zarah. And that is only according to the old information
Rabbi Paschkes, like, respectfully, you're mixing up two things. Kishkish Makel is the Derech Avodasa, right? And it's Chayim.
Can you explain?
That is how they serve. It's not a gift. That is how they serve the Avodah Zarah. That is the
so
type
this is
of
exactly,
avodah. Like,
this is exactly
whereas the Shviras Makel is the Takravis Avodah Zarah. And since the avodah is with Kishkush, you could have a Takravis Al Yidei Shvira.
That's
right?
Not what Rashi says. Rashi says that Kishkush itself is Vivadai, this is Derech Avodah, this is considered
right.
Takravis.
That is an avodah.
So what does that mean? Does that mean the Kishkush Makel meant afterwards they threw it to the Getchka?
No. Kishkush is Derech Avodasa, and Shvira is. Let's continue. So let's go back. So do you think the Kaimrim, what's your point? The Kaimrim don't know what they're talking about? Like, what's your point?
No. My point is that by asking Kaimrim if this is considered an offering, and even if they would say that it's not an offering, this does not make it not be Derech Avodah. Derech Avodah means anything that is Mekubal by the Avodah Zarah, that this action is considered a nachas ruach for the elul, and this is exactly what's happening by the tantering. They believe
you're arguing on Ramesha and the first Pshak of El Yashiv, who said that the Kaimrim do know, and you're saying now the Kaimrim don't know, and it is. Let me ask you a second question. Who says that it's the servers that define what is Davaida? Maybe it's the Kaimrim that define what is Davaida.
That's something didn't go through the halacha part of that.
Well, I'm asking you that question. If it's the actual, well, you're saying the Kaimrim also believe it's Avodah Zarah. That's what you're saying, right?
Yes, they don't know the definition of Avodah Zarah for us.
So you're saying, okay, you're saying that the Kaimrim who say it's not Avodah Zarah are wrong, and it really is Avodah Zarah. That's your argument.
It's the argument is if they can define to us what means Derech Avodah. Can you explain me in your own? I would love you should explain me in your own words what Derech Avodah means. What does the word Avodah Zarah mean?
The word Avodah Zarah is bowing to an Avodah Zarah is Derech Avodasa, right? When you give fruit in front of the Avodah Zarah, that's a carbon to the Avodah Zarah.
Yes.
Right. Davening to the Rabbeinu Shel Olam Havdol is called an Avodah, right? A carbon is a carbon. It's two different things, right? You bow down to the Avodah Zarah, you makabel el malchus of the Avodah Zarah is one thing, and then you could send money to the Avodah Zarah, you could send a gift to the Avodah Zarah. It's a very clear difference.
Okay. Let's bring for an example by the Eivishter, considering mitzvahs. Let's take, for example, the mitzvah of Nesilat Lilith. the mitzvah of Netilas Lilith, if this would be on a oisin from Shvira, let's say the pasuk would say Shvartam Lechem B'Yam Arishim, we make a bracha Shkedushana B'Mitzvah of Tzvon El Shviras Lilith. Is this considered a mitzvah, an avodah? How do you define that?
Are mitzvahs called avodah? It could be a mitzvah called an avodah. It's a complicated
probably not.
Issue.
It's probably not.
I mean, but Pashtus La'avde B'chal of Avchem goes on tefillah. Is a mitzvah also a type of an avodah? There are rayas lakan or lakan, but Pashtus La'avde goes on tefillah, right?
Exactly. So by us, a mitzvah is considered a mitzvah, an avodah is considered an avodah. Now, L'havdil Elef Alef Havdalos, when we talk about avodah zara, the way that Rashi explains derech avodah, that means anything
right.
that we believe that Chas V'Shalom, that the goy believes that the avodah zara has hanor from them, that includes avodas mitzvahs, minhagim, whatever they do as deeming the avodah zara by giving it, by doing some type of mitzvah for it, that is considered derech avodah. Now, if you ask the priests to know
is a carbon also derech avodah zara? Giving it a gift is also derech avodah zara?
That's for sure derech avodah.
The kishkish makel is
okay. I'm just quoting this thing that the kishkish makel.
One is chayiv misa and one is chayiv miso and one isn't. So carbon is one is nesar and one is just. Rabbi Fashkus, thank you very much. I appreciated your time. Okay.
I would just finish with one thing.
Yeah.
Just in conclusion, I would love people should know that when looking into this halacha and this whole shaila over here. It's one big part of why people are taking it easy is that what I think that the shaila in it here is we didn't grow up with the Isra of the Kribis of Edizara. If this would be a shaila of Shmir Shabbos or any other halacha and Tariq mitzvahs, people would take it real serious. And here we're talking about something that every on the top that this is considered of Edizara, the Kribis of Edizara, there are two laven on it every time a person has an oath from it. It's Le'id Ubriyaz Chama Umar Macherem. And then there's the Ramon in Simon Kifni and Zion, and the Gro holds that way that the Krebs of Edizara is in Klal of Yeherek Val Yaver. So this is really something that it should be left to the Rabbanim to Paskin on that and taken real serious the Shaila.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Pashkus. Cult of all the best. Bye bye. We have on the phone with us from New York City, Mrs. Berger. Who's a researcher who provides the Rabbanim in Eretz Yisrael and in America the information that they use to, asser the Indian or human hair sheitlach. Welcome, Mrs. Berger.
Thank you.
So we've had on, I think, two Indian priests, a Baal Tshuva who actually lived in India for 6 months, and a lady who spent 30 years of her life studying here. I mean, you talk about a lot of times, you know, I'm criticized for spending too much time, you know, but my secular compatriots say, what, you spend so much time studying law, Jewish law? And I say, imagine somebody spent 30 years studying Indian here. So we wanted to have as many researchers on from all sides. So we've had, this week we have Rabbi Pashkus, last week we had the other fellow, and we have Mrs. Berger, so tell us, share with us your knowledge in this area.
Okay, so I got interested because this past summer there was a little bit of a hullabaloo about the Indian hair. Again, I'm not looking to ask or sheeples. I just wanted to find out the real facts about the tonsuring. So I decided to look into it just because I was curious, and I'd read an English report that was reviewed by Rebelsky, and, you know, Rebelsky was a very big giant, and I wasn't looking to Chas V'Shalom go against Rebelsky's stock. I just was curious to know about the tonsuring, and I started to just, as Rafiman said, I started to just Google it. That's what started it. And I did see this legend about this, you know, I'm not even sure if I'm allowed to say her name, but this, you know, princess who gave her hair to this avodah zara, and because of that action, the hair is considered, anyone that tonsors at Tirumala receives blessings from this avodah zara, and this other avodah zara who gave her hair receives all the hair. She seems to receive it. So I was pretty amazed by this because I hadn't read this in Rebelsky's report, and I decided to do something a little bit strange maybe, but just to get a thorough, you know, view of this, I contacted the TTD, which is, they run the temple in Tirumala. They're the trust board that runs it. And I sent an email to the information center, and it was interesting. Within a few days, I received an email back from the supervisor, and I had asked them, what was the reason, the belief behind the tonsuring? And the first thing they wrote back to me was this legend, that this is the legend behind the tonsuring. And then they did write that, it also represents, giving up the false ego, but the first response and the main religious reason seems to be this legend. So I started to do more intense research, and I contacted a few different organizations in India. There's another organization called the TTY, which is the Tirumala Tirupati Yatra, and they were very kind, and they answered a lot of my questions. And I contacted, actually, there's a famous comic book series. It's called Amar Chitra Katha, and it's very popular in India. It started in 1967. They printed over 100 million copies of comic books that have gone worldwide, and they have it in over 1,000 bookstores in India. In 2011, they actually issued a series on this legend. They added about the legends of Tirumala, and they focused on one book on Tirupati on this legend. And at the end, they wrote that this is the reason for the tonsuring. So I actually emailed the executive director of this comic book. Her name is Reena Puri, and I asked her, where is the story coming from, and do people know about it, and what is the belief with the story? And she wrote back to me that this is the most quoted story regarding the shaving of head at Tirupati, and yes, most devotees who have their head shaved do know the story and believe in it. So I just was so amazed, and the more research that I did...
Can I ask you, Mrs. Berger, a question?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that... if you would be your average person and you go see, let's say, people go to Daven by the Kivrei Tzadikim,
mm-hmm.
right? I think the Lubavitcher Rebbe's Keva, I don't know, gets 1 million visitors a year, right?
Okay.
It would seem that Jews daven to dead people, right?
Okay.
And that would be a problem. Wouldn't that be a problem with Avodah Zarah?
Could you clarify your question? What do you mean?
You're davening to a dead person,
right?
And you're not supposed to daven. It's bilti l'Hashem levada. You're supposed to daven. So all these people, these million people, are going to daven of the Avodah Zarah. Well, for that matter, I was just in Eretz Yisrael. You go to the Belza Rebbe's Keva. I went to Reb Moshe, but he doesn't get Reb Moshe. He's the next to Baruch LaBelza. I don't know. 1 million people a year go there, and it would seem that to an outsider, it would look like a big chelik of our brethren and now have become over the Avodah Zarah, they're davening to dead people. Is that problematic?
Okay. How is that connected to the tonsuring and the legend? I'm not understanding the connection.
I'm just showing you that when you look at something and you take, you ask a regular person, he would say, yes, they're davening to dead people. But the answer is they're not davening to dead people.
But see, this
right?
is not, this not only...
So my point is that you can't take somebody and let's paskin from comic books and from things and let's paskin.
No, I'm not.
We would kill 2 million people, the people who
live in
there and there. We start killing 2 million Jews a year, right?
You're right, and I'm not. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting. Emma Tarla herself, she has in her own book that this is the official legend behind the tonsuring.
So when she appeared, but I agree with you, but when she appeared on our program and we asked
mm-hmm.
her that, she said that is clearly it's part of the legend, but it's not why it's done. So she didn't lie to me, I don't believe, when she was on the air here, right?
No,
she's
I don't
obviously
think she's
very.
Lying,
so she's obviously very aware of the legend, and she's saying, yes, it's part of, there's a lot of pictures here. I could give you five other examples of where you would look at Yiddishkeit, and you're not a Talmud Chacham, and you don't know the Shulchan Aruch, you don't know Halacha, you would say, yes, this is Avodah Zarah.
Okay, so I just want to say that I'm not looking to give a psak whether this is Avodah Zarah or not, but this is clearly, if you would go online and research every single website and every single blog and all the articles that are in different magazines, they quote this story as the reason for the tonsuring. I'm not saying this is the quoted story, and not only that.
We agree with you.
I'm not deciding. Mm-hmm.
So we've had on a number of priests, right, from the temple,
mm-hmm.
right?
Okay.
And we asked them what it is, and they say clearly not, and they're aware of the legend.
Which temple are they from? Because the Tirumala Temple, which is where the largest, amount of hair is tonsured, that is a belief in Tirumala. They believe in Tirumala that this
right.
is why they're tonsuring. Other temples, they have different legends, but this is the legend.
We've had on priests from whose expertise is Tirumala. We'll have one on this week. And we
mm-hmm.
go through all the different Avodah Zarahs they have. And he says, no, this is for this reason, and this is for that reason. notwithstanding all the legends, that's not why it's done. So I think if you could think, well, Havdol Me'el Favdolos in Yiddishkeit, you could take 10,000 Midrashim and say, according to this, if you look at it, it seems like, well, that's isn't that what, you know, why we, to interpret a Midrash, you can't be like a layperson or to, so wouldn't that, would you think that that's a good analogy to us trying to interpret the Indian religion?
Well, I think considering that the TTD runs the Tirumala Temple, they're the ones who are currently in charge. They oversee everything that's involved in the temple. And they are saying this as the main story behind the tonsuring, and they're promoting this. They're marketing it everywhere. So it's coming from somewhere. It's from the Puranas. They have, there's a book from the TTD itself where it says, they write in there, I could get it right over here, it says, right here, as per Puranas, hair offered by devotees is to cover up the lost hair. It is a very small portion to Lord Venkateswara Swami. That is their reason that they're giving. So this is the main religious belief. I think all the other reasons, like shedding the ego and humility, which is definitely, it seems to be a reason, and I think it's also a side effect of tonsuring, because when they remove the hair, they feel humility. But the main religious belief, as in all the actions of, in Hinduism, it seems there's a legend behind things, you know, so this is the legend behind the tonsuring. It's very, very clear. And I think this is coming from the higher authorities, too. I don't know why the priest didn't mention it. Again, I'm not looking to argue or debate what the priests are saying. I'm telling you what I found online and what I see has been given to me dirt by emails from many different sources in India. Like the Tirumala Tirupathiyatra has an entire website, and they promote, you know, they want to spread their religion and the beliefs, and they, too, wrote this story as the main reason. Actually, as a matter of fact, there's a hill in Tirumala. There are seven holy hills in Tirumala. One of them is called Neeladri. And if you look it up, if you Google it, you'll see that Neeladri is named this name because of the actions of this princess, whose name is Neeladevi, who gave her hair to Lord Vishnu. So if this was just a random story, there wouldn't be a holy hill in Tirumala named after this Avodah Zarah. This is the story behind the concept.
I understand that, and we've asked this to the priest as well as the expert in the world, and their response was, yes, we give up the hair, we give our hair as a sacrifice of our ego. And you'll hear the priest who's on today, I ask him three times, I say, what's the difference between this and there's another Avodah there, Abraham or something? He said, that's a gift. He says, but the hair is something that's considered unclean and disgusting, and you wash it off, and you give that is given as showing I don't have any ego as a prerequisite. So, I mean, we could sit here and argue all day, you know, whether the Galochim have it right or not, but they have this story, and this is how. So,
you know, there's something interesting what you're saying.
Could you imagine if some mm-hmm. Jesuit priest came along and started paskering shilas based upon halachas he found on the internet? I mean, we've asked the priest,
okay,
and they say,
I'm not,
the
I'm
story
not
is true.
This.
He's saying the
okay.
story is true, and this is what it means. So we
Mr.
disagree.
Okay, I'm not looking to go against Indian priests. I'm just trying to explain to you that if you look at the information and if you read the accounts of pilgrims, and again, I know that this is not necessarily decided by the pilgrims' thoughts in giving the hair. It's decided by the people that are in higher authority there, which is the priests and probably the TTD and the people there. But definitely the pilgrims that are giving their hair, they do believe and know the story, and they are giving the hair because they do think it's a gift. As a matter of fact, they consider all of Tirumala holy, and there are rules in Tirumala, like you can't, there's a no-fly zone, you can't bring alcohol, many other rules that they have, because the entire area is considered holy. So when they go to the tonsuring hall to tonsure their hair, they feel like they're standing before the deity. They actually virtually think the hair goes to the deity. They do. In many emails that they send back to me from the TTD and the TTY, they wrote to me that they don't even have to go into the temple because they feel like they're giving it directly from the Kalinakata, which is the tonsuring hall. They feel like it's going virtually to the Avodah Zarah, and they are accepting it, and Neeladevi is accepting this hair. Now, it's up to the Rabbanim to decide if this is a problem. It's definitely is being taken seriously by Rabbanim. Now, there are Rabbanim
But, Ms. Berger, who is the they mm-hmm. who says that they think they're giving it to the deity?
Here, I can read you the email from the Tirumala Tirupathiyatra if you want me to read it to you.
No, just tell me.
But it's clearly
emails from who? Emails from who?
From the TTD and the Tirumala Tirupathiyatra. And even like Rina Puri, the head of the... It's not just a comic book. You have to understand. This is the history book for the Indian people. There are over 1,000... you know, stores that carry this comic book, and they have over 100 million readers, and it's something that has shaped their culture. It's not, if you look online at these comic books, it's not a comic book. It's considered a history book in India. And this story, I could read you what they write. It's very clear. At the end of it, overwhelmed by her selfless act, Vishnu decreed that whoever came to worship him would sacrifice their hair to her. Even now, thousands of Vishnu's devotees flocked to Tirupati and offered this highly unusual gift. This is a gift. This is, they're giving their hair to the Bodhisattva. It's clear. You said the priest even confirmed the story. Amitala has it in her book as the official legend behind the tonsuring. It's clearly the legend, and they clearly are thinking that it's going to the Bodhisattva, and the Bodhisattva is accepting this hair.
So why does Emma Tarlow in her interview with us say that is a very superficial reading and is not the intent? Like, why is she?
Okay, so I'm not looking to say anything against Emma Tarlow. I'm sure she knows her research. I'm sure she's very informed. But she did write, and she wrote it herself. This is the official legend behind the tonsuring. So
we already established that from legends and comic books you can't paskin.
It's from the Purana.
But when we had Emma Tarlow, who's on, who's the number one expert in the world on this, and are we supposed to believe the emails? Are we supposed to believe the living testimony of the number one expert in the world?
So it's not just an email. If you go and look at it in the Puranas, they have it in the Puranas. There's a source for the story. If you look at the TTV, their website, they have the story there. If you, again, the hill, there's a hill, a holy hill named after this Avodah Zarah. It's not just a legend. It is a very important legend behind the tonsuring.
Without a doubt.
Something else that you should know that I think is very interesting, and again, I'm not arguing with the hair going into the Hundi or not. I know that the priests say it's not allowed in, but the TTD does have two e-books on their website. You could go on their website and look at the e-books. They have two books that were actually published and issued by the TTD, where they write about the Hundi inside the temple. And I think everyone's getting very confused because there are different Hundis. There's one in the tonsuring hall, one outside the temple, and then there's the main one inside the temple that's near the deity. That's where they feel like they're giving offerings to the deity. And they have in these two books that are issued by the TTD that pilgrims will bring in all sorts of offerings. You know, it says over here, coins and valuables and gold, and it also says tonsured here. So I find it very confusing because here, they range from hairs removed from the shaven heads of men and women to diamond jewelry, ornamental necklaces, earrings, gold bangles, etc., etc. That is deposited inside the temple in the Hundi there. So, I emailed, again, I know you don't like emails, but I did some research and I asked the TTY about it, and he said that sometimes women will get three cuts of their hair instead of tonsuring all their hair, will just get three cuts, and they will bring it in and put it into the Hundi in the temple as an offering. But then again, he wrote to me, but many don't feel like they have to because they feel like just by doing it in the tonsuring hall, it's going there to the deity. So there is something that Rabbanim have to look into. There's a reason why Rabbanim are looking into this research, because there seems to be a question mark on it. Again, I don't know what the conclusion will be.
Ms. Berger, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Take care.